approached to write a book for a good 6 months by various agents and publishers, but I kept saying no because I have great respect for authors, and I didn't want to think I could not write books my whole life and suddenly do the story justice. And then I had I said to one agent or one friend, you know, I've never written anything longer than 20 pages. Television scripts are a completely different form. And he said, 20 pages, great, just do that 10 times. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe I could do that. And it turned out to be far more complicated. But had he not said that, I probably would have never attempted. And so, yeah, I spent 2 months interviewing, and then I spent about 15, 16 months, I'd say, writing.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Alan Kim. And this week, our guest is Lisa Fenn. She is a former ESPN producer and the author of a new book, Carry On, a story of resilience, redemption, and an unlikely family. Lisa Fenn is part of what I think is the best piece that ESPN has ever run on its airwaves. A story about two wrestlers at one of Cleveland's toughest public high schools. One of those wrestlers was legally blind. The other had lost his legs at age 11. Lisa Fenn is a producer who comes and pitches her network on doing a story on these two, goes to Cleveland to do the story, and then ends up becoming essentially the mother of these two kids. Never leaves them after being involved in this story. And it's an incredible family that they have formed. Lisa Fenn, D'Artagnan Crockett, who is a Paralympics athlete who will be competing in Rio in judo, and Leroy Sutton, who is now works for a video game company in Louisiana. It's really an amazing story, and I can't recommend enough. If you just Google Carry On ESPN, you will see the story narrated by Tom Rinaldi, I believe produced by Jose Morales. And it's just an amazing story about this sort of amazing family that all got together. So Lisa has a book out on just the whole story and what happened. It's going to be turned into a movie as well. Not surprisingly, because it's just a crazy, amazing story. And so I'm really looking forward to speaking with her. I believe she's in Massachusetts, and we bring in Lisa Fenn, the former ESPNer, producer, who is now an accomplished author. And your book, Lisa, it will soon be a motion picture. Your life has changed dramatically, Lisa, since 2009.
Yeah, hearing all that, I feel like you must certainly be talking about someone else. It has been quite a change of roles for me. Even being on this show, I'm used to being the one doing interviews. So.
Yeah, I know. As a producer, Lisa, I know it would be in your general POV to start directing things and placing stuff, but we're okay here. We have producers. You're the guest.
Yeah, I'm going to restrain myself.
Restrain yourself. All right, so you sent me the book. I appreciate that. I read it. I'm obviously familiar with the story, having written about Carry On a number of times in the media column. So first off, I want to just ask you a general question. And that is, why do you think people latched on to this story? There are other stories of kids who overcome things in impoverished areas. There are kids who win Paralympic medals, like D'Artagnan. There are stories even of people like yourself who find kids and either formally adopt them or become these untraditional families. But there was something about this story. And whatever it turned out to be, 5 million people downloaded this story on ESPN.com and watched it on ESPN. So what do you, now that you're 7 years removed, what was it? What do you think, why do you think this seemed to catch or tug at so many people?
Yeah, you know, that's a fascinating question, and literally one I was just asking myself last night again, because even though we're, 3 years removed from it, I still field at least one, usually three or four emails a day from people who are either still seeing it for the first time or have watched it again and just felt the need to reach out to us. And I was just saying the same thing to my husband last night. I said, the internet is filled with these stories of inspiration. are they all, you know, receiving this attention? But I think what's really, there's a lot of things that were unique about our journey together. One is that there's three main characters in it. And so I think it's easy for just about anyone to find someone that they relate to or connect to. Leroy suffering the traumas that he went through, D'Artagnan, you know, suffering the loss that he went through, this theme of friendship, this the notion of poverty, of disability. And a lot of feedback that we receive or emails we receive are from people who are really down on their luck themselves and see Leroy and D'Artagnan and feel like, if they could do it, I can do it. We met a boy just a few months ago at D'Artagnan's national qualifier for Rio. We were in Dallas, and a boy had driven over an hour to come to the competition just in hopes that he might see D'Artagnan, not knowing that I would be there as well. And he had recently gotten out of drug rehab. And at drug rehab, they have a curriculum based around Carry On, and they develop accountability partners that they call Carry On partners, and just told us this really powerful story of how it had impacted his life. So there's that element of it. And then there's the element where people who are operating from positions of strength in their life, but have always wanted to sort of reach out and do more or give more, see this, that, you know, I'm just your normal average everyday person as well, and think, I can do this too. And so I hear from a lot of people who say, you know, I've driven by that home for juvenile boys for the last 20 years on my way to work, and today I stopped and got an application. A family in my neighborhood became foster parents after seeing it. So I think there's sort of three storylines that intersect that gives more people more avenues to sort of connect and relate.
I want to, you know, the book sort of retraces the, not just the history of you meeting these two, at the time, boys, now men. But you also go back and clearly report and interview many of the people in their lives who were not covered in the initial stories that we saw on ESPN. How, I don't know if the word is odd, but what is it like to re-report a story that you are part of?
Yeah, that was quite a fascinating experience, because Leroy and D'Artagnan knew a few things about their childhoods, but I mean, they were 8, 10 years old, so the level of detail needed to report in a book, they didn't have. So I spent 2 months in Cleveland. My parents watched my little ones, and I did about 75, 85 interviews. I tracked down every family member I could, every doctor, teacher, bus driver, coach, neighborhood friend, paramedic, and just spent hours and hours getting their stories. And I learned so much more about Leroy and D'Artagnan. I mean, we were already so close, but it really deepened my level of understanding for how they became who they became. And for every story that I tell in the book, I made sure I at least had two corroborating sources on every anecdote. And it was so valuable for Leroy and D'Artagnan as well to just sort of put together these black holes that they had in their childhood. For Leroy, especially after being hit by a train, spending months in the hospital, he had sort of learned as a coping mechanism to just block out a lot of those memories. But the whole experience became healing for him and just bonding for all of us to get a deeper understanding of what happened to them.
For the three of you, are you now comfortable with being, for lack of a better phrase, public people, or is it still odd for you to be the subject of interviews, or, you know, even for Leroy and D'Artagnan, to see their life story now in a book is a very public thing.
It is. I think for me as a producer, I'll always be more comfortable behind the camera and in the back of the stage. But what's given me the courage to do this was seeing how empowered that they were finding their voice, to see them get comfortable on a stage. You know, their whole life they felt like their childhoods were things that they should be ashamed of and hidden and not worth remembering, let alone sharing. But helping them find words for what they went through, to be able to express those traumas has really, the talking has been like oxygen for them. It's really given them new life. It's helped them see that these are experiences that so many other people go through, and that we have a power to, you know, to do something good in the world by sharing these stories and connecting with people and letting them know that they're not alone. And so there's nothing more that I love than, you know, being out and speaking somewhere with them or being in an event with them and just seeing how talking and sharing has helped them to grow and mature and really find a purpose.
Lisa, how often are you with them? Obviously, D'Artagnan is training. He's a world-class judoka, I believe is the right word. And he's competing in the Rio Paralympics. The last time I had talked to you, I think Leroy had graduated college and was living somewhere out west. So what is, you might as well actually update us on where they are now and how often you see them.
Yes, Leroy is living now in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He works as a game tester for EA. He's been there since January. He's loving it. That's his dream, to work in the gaming industry. And he's aspiring to eventually be an artist. D'Artagnan is still living in Colorado Springs. He trains at the Olympic Training Center. He's qualified for Rio and heads down there September 3rd, and we're all going. I see them at least once a month. I see one of them at least once a month, usually more, for various speaking engagements, or if D'Artagnan has a break, he'll often come to my house and be with my family. I see them on holidays. I talk to them just about every day. So it has amazed us that there, you know, a lot of things could have derailed this dynamic, but we've managed to grow ever closer.
Yeah, I think this is from your book. I think you said something to the effect of, in 2 years' time, you essentially became a mother to four children of different races, ages, and abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so your family, which now obviously Leroy and D'Artagnan are part of, is an interesting one because they're in their 20s. And do you have two children under the age of 10, including one adopted child and one natural birth child? Do I have that right?
Yes, correct.
Okay, so that is, I mean, you know, you are the living embodiment of a post-racial society. So congratulations to you. But that's a really fascinating family. How what's the dynamic, and what is the dynamic between the two little ones with these two older boys?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Like when we adopted our son Saxon, he's an African American child from Cleveland, and we were given a lot of advice, particularly on how we need to be careful to make sure our lives are diversified so that he has African American role models and authority figures in our lives, which we were really excited to do. And so the fact that Leroy and D'Artagnan came into our family at the same time, my 6-year-old sees them as his big brothers. He has pictures of him in his room for his 6th birthday. He literally asked for a wheelchair so he could be like Leroy. My daughter is crazy about them. She's always asking when they're going to visit. And my son has now been inspired to take up judo. When he first asked, I thought this was just a passing request, but he's been training now for 7 months and it's his favorite thing to do. So they've played a huge role with my little ones. They absolutely adore them.
Did your adoption of Saxon happen because of the meeting of with D'Artagnan and Leroy because you were in Cleveland, or was that a separate story on its own?
No, I had been drawn towards adoption since I was a child. It was always something I wanted to do. But Leroy and D'Artagnan definitely played a role in my husband coming around to this idea, because he saw how close we were growing and he came to really understand that blood doesn't necessarily have to make a family. And so we decided to adopt our first one, and we chose Cleveland, both in honor of Leroy and D'Artagnan and also my birthplace. I wanted to have that commonality with a child. So, everything was just beautifully and unexpectedly woven together.
Lisa, what was the process of actually writing? You know, obviously you have decades of experience interviewing people, that's not really an issue for you. But to then sit down and write a 200 plus page book, that is not an easy thing to do. So what was your process? When did you write? How did you do it?
Yeah, it was the hardest thing I think I've ever done. The interviewing was even a learning curve, because interviewing for television features, the questions are very much framed as, well, how did that make you feel? And what were you thinking at that moment? You know, the facts kind of come in the narrated tracks. But in book writing, you need to know, I need all those details up front. So it's not just how are you feeling, but it's what were you wearing and what time of day was it? And what do you remember about the weather? And so I was really learning a lot through that as well. But yeah, the book writing process, I was approached to write a book for a good 6 months by various agents and publishers, but I kept saying no because I have great respect for authors, and I didn't want to think I could not write books my whole life and suddenly do the story justice. And then I said to one agent or one friend, you know, I've never written anything longer than 20 pages. Television scripts are a completely different form. And he said, 20 pages, great. Just do that 10 times. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe I could do that. And it turned out to be far more complicated. But had he not said that, I probably would have never attempted. And so I spent 2 months interviewing, and then I spent about 15-16 months, I'd say, writing, because I have two preschoolers here at home. They're not the most supportive of carving out writing time, but I hired some help during the days and locked myself in the library and just got it done.
Nice. All right, so there you go, future authors. Write, look at it as 10 pages 20 times and you've got yourself a book. That's the way to do it. You know, obviously the story, obviously it's hard for you to step back because you are living it. But if you step back, the story really does make for a great narrative film. And I believe that the rights to the screenplay or a film have been sold. I think the Leroy and D'Artagnan's life rights have been sold. Where does the potential for a film stand right now?
Yeah, we optioned our life rights last fall to Walden Studios, and they have they're not a distributor, they're a developer, but they work very closely with Fox Films, which is the likely partner for this film. They also hired Nate Parker to write the screenplay. Nate is best known for winning all of Sundance this year for his film Birth of a Nation, which is released this October. We are very excited about Nate because he was an All-American wrestler at Oklahoma. He grew up with some poverty struggles. He's an African-American. And so he just connects with our story on a whole lot of levels. So we've spent some time talking with him, and he is about halfway through his writing process. And we're quite honored that he took this on.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back on the Sports Illustrated podcast after this. All right, you've been watching the Olympics. You've been thrilled that Michael Phelps and Katie Ledecky and Usain Bolt coming up. SI has a daily Olympics podcast hosted by Alex Abnos and Mitch Goldich. You got to check it out. It's if you're an Olympics fan, it's basically these guys recap what happened the day before and look ahead in terms of what's coming up. So that's Sports Illustrated at the Games, SI's Olympic podcast. Check it out. Lisa, one of the things in the book that really is striking is just how many people reached out offering support for these two. From the beginnings, immediately you getting emails and you were staying up night after night to respond to people. And then some like real heavy hitters came in and said, you know, I'd like to pay for college for these guys, or I'd like to make sure that they have a foundation over the next 5 to 10 years. So a couple questions off that. Do donations come in for them still? And is there, from what I understand, you've sort of set up some kind of fund for them, right? That provides them access even to this day.
Yeah. So after my story aired in 2009, yeah, floods of people were asking how to give money, and I hadn't been prepared for that. I mean, I've produced over 200 feature stories, and nobody ever emailed me wanting to give money. So this caught me off guard, but we did quickly set up a trust fund in 2009. About $50,000 came into that. And then, as you said, they had a trio of supporters who wrote wanting to fund their whole education. So those three families split the cost in third.
Wow.
And have also served as just amazing mentors for Leroy and D'Artagnan. They are very much a part of our family as well. And so the money that went into the fund, it was used and is used for things like medical care, vision care. Leroy needs a new wheelchair every couple of years, which is $5,000. It helped us relocate him from Phoenix, where he was going to college, to Louisiana, where he's now working, because he's making peanuts. And it helped us in the beginning when D'Artagnan needed money for tournament travel before he had achieved sort of elite status and was a funded athlete. You know, we had to pay for all his trips to try to qualify, and it's expensive. So that fund was absolutely paramount in pulling those two out of poverty, because I made a decent living, but I couldn't afford the needs that they had at that time. Money is no longer coming into it. After 2013, we never asked for donations after that feature aired, but to our surprise, they came anyway. And there was several more $1,000 that came in. So there's a little bit left in that account that I'm holding on to, just to ensure that I've got them to a place where they're truly self-sufficient. And then once we're confident of that, we are hoping to set up, turn it into a foundation where we can give kids who grew up like them similar chances. Mm. We're not quite sure yet if that's going to be scholarships or through a mentoring program that we do, but they really have a desire to give back and pay forward all that's been done for them.
Did those families ever want to come public, or did they stay behind, or have they stayed behind the scenes?
One of them prefers to stay anonymous. He is a prominent executive at a wealth management firm, and so for him, it's more of an issue of he just doesn't ever want, he helps a lot of kids in this position, and he never wants people saying, well, why did you choose this one and not that one?
Right.
So he prefers to stay anonymous. The other two families, I don't know that they've ever been approached publicly, but they are named in the book. So yeah, one of them is a family named the Leventhals in New York City. And the other family is in Colorado, or in Winter Park, Colorado.
Lisa, you covered a lot of, how long did you work for ESPN?
I was there for 13 years.
Okay, 13 years. You did a lot of features, both uplifting, but also traditional sports stories, probably some features too, where athletes had gone off the rails. This whole journey for you over the last 7 or 8 years or so, has it, we live in times where sometimes, especially if you watch the political news, it's tough to remember that there are people out there who really want to do good and want to help other people. Has your experience with D'Artagnan and Leroy changed what you think overall of society? Or did you, because I know you, religion was a part of your upbringing, have you always sort of steadfastly believed that people inherently are good and people inherently want to help people?
Well, I think it's certainly a mix, but I do think there's more people who want to be helpful than the country gets credit for. They just don't always know the mechanism or the pathway to do that. I've had a lot of people ask me, how can I do what you did? And quite honestly, I don't know. You can't really walk into an impoverished area with a TV camera and say, I'm going to tell your story and everything's going to change. This was clearly a very unique circumstance. But what I kind of share is whether we are, regardless of your spiritual persuasion, I think we all kind of agree on the golden rule to love thy neighbor as thyself. And when I say that, I kind of see that that mantra begs three questions. Who is your neighbor? what is their need? How can I meet that in love? And your neighbor could literally be your neighbor. It could be a program in your community that grabs your heart. It could be a child in your children's school who is in need. I read recently about a school in Michigan that has a group of women that they call themselves the Guardian Angels, and they just took it upon themselves to give teachers several hundred dollars each year. And when the teachers saw a need, like a child's glasses were broken or they didn't have a winter coat to go meet it. And so, yeah, I think there's a ton of people doing good that are not necessarily on television like we were. But through sharing our story, it's sort of inspired more people to find the pathway that they can use their powers for good as well.
Do you miss working at ESPN at all? And if so, why?
I miss it terribly, actually. I never imagined I'd be telling the same story for 7 years. Not that I'm complaining, but yeah, I really do. When I left staff and we moved to Boston, I was expecting to still, I had a contract to produce X number of features a year from here. My husband took a job up here. But the week that we moved, I learned I was pregnant and I had a really difficult pregnancy. So it was clear that I wasn't going to be going back to work soon. And then I had suddenly had two kids under the age of two, and this story sort of kept going, and it was clear this is what I'd be doing for this season of life. But I do miss it terribly. I was just reading about the series that ESPN is doing on the Pin Kings, and I know John Fish, he's the producer of it. I used to sit right behind him, and I just sort of had that yearning, like, oh, I would love to be working on that. So I think I'll eventually make my way back to producing. I'm not quite sure when. But ESPN was the first and only place that I worked, and there's not a lot of, you know, staff feature television jobs, especially in sports, and at least in our department, they treated us very well, and I learned so much, and I worked with really quality people. I love the storytelling, I love the creativity, so I miss a lot of things about it.
Would you, if you came back to producing, would you want to stay in sports or would you want to expand beyond sports?
Oh, no, I would consider going beyond sports. I love the drama of sports and live sporting events. And, you know, sports is largely a vehicle to tell the stories of the heart to me. So, but yeah, I would consider doing that in other ways too.
All right, Lisa, here's the last thing I want to finish with. And again, the book is Carry On. I can't recommend it enough. In addition, go if you have not, and there will be some of you who have not seen this feature on ESPN. Again, Google Carry On ESPN, and or Lisa Fenn or any of the names who are part of the story. And again, I think it's the best feature ESPN has ever done. Probably the best thing the network's ever done. Although that's obviously a subjective.
You're very kind.
Yeah, I am. The best thing the network has ever done, perhaps, is not re-sign Skip Bayless. But although they did want to, ironically enough, no. But this, in all seriousness, is, in my opinion, it's the best PC ESPN has done.
Lisa, what resonated about it with you? I'll just turn the table once.
Come on, Lisa, you're not allowed to ask questions. No, what resonated with me is that one, it was a truly honest and authentic story, and writing about sports media. And you do become a little bit cynical. You see so often things that are not authentic, and a lot of that is in studio-based programming. And when you see something that jumps off the screen, that's just really honest and speaks to the sort of the better angels, you step back. The other thing is ESPN allowed that story the length it deserved, 20-plus minutes that essentially it was almost unheard of by your...
That was shocking.
...by your network. And then finally... You know, you had everything that a story really sort of makes you step back and go, you know, here's this white 30-something woman from Massachusetts who floats in on a story, which any of us in the media understand that we always do a lot of parachuting into stories. We get people to tell us their, you know, some of the most important things in their life, and then we leave. Sometimes we stay in touch with them, but it's always through the prism of, you know, the phone, or it's not really direct connection, and you stayed. I think that's in the end what stuck with me, is that you stayed with your subjects forever, for real, and that just generally doesn't happen. And I think that's what stuck with me. All right. So now, Lisa, now that I've answered a question on my podcast, let me finish by this. We'll end it on a lighter note. I love the fact that in addition to interviewing with ESPN, as you talked about in your book, you were serious about maybe perhaps working for the CIA. You went through numerous interviews. And one of the great things I loved about your book is that they said, because you are, you're very unassuming and, you know, you don't really strike someone as like, you know, a La Femme Nikita type, that you could have been used by the CIA in a number of situations. That was, what are your recollections of just that whole interviewing process and the fact that the CIA was like, you know, you come off like an everywoman and that would be very valuable to us.
Yeah, I remember that vividly. Because as I say in the book, like I kind of applied just because my dad said, the CIA would take you. Like, I was a pretty notorious scaredy cat. But the farther I got into the interview process, the more intriguing it was. And I will never forget that agent saying, because I said, why are you interested in me? I had virtually none of the requirements. No foreign language experience, no political science experience, no foreign travel. And he just kind of said, well, we could use you in a variety of different ways. We could, you know, dress you up as a teenager and you could go to school with the children of informants, or you could, you know, you look like someone that people would trust. That's what he said to me.
That's amazing. you ever sort of play the game, extrapolate in your mind what would have happened had you joined the CIA?
Oh, yeah, I do. I actually just finished reading a book called Blowing My Cover, My Life as a CIA Spy. And it's about a girl who named Lindsay Moran, who was in the CIA for a handful of years. It's a pretty funny book, but I like to think that would have been my alternate path.
Nice. And now I'm going to start thinking of ESPN feature producers as potential CIA agents, which will be fun.
Oh, that's going to give you a lot of content.
Which will be a fun exercise for me. All right, the guest has been Lisa Fenn. Her book is Carry On, and that is the story, obviously, of Lisa and the you know, how her life changed from this assignment that she went on in 2009 to Cleveland, where she ended up meeting these two extraordinary kids, D'Artagnan and Leroy. And now they have become a family, a truly modern American family. And it's great to hear that both are doing well. And for the people who are Olympics fans on this podcast, check out D'Artagnan, who will be in Rio at the Paralympics. And you'll be able to follow him online, I'm sure.
He competes on Saturday, September 10th.
September 10th.
I'll be there.
Awesome. Awesome. Yes. Safe travels. All right, Lisa, listen, thank you so much. We've talked over the years. And again, I'm a great admirer of the story and what you did. And just sort of how you approached life. So I wish the book tour and the possibility of a movie coming up, nothing but the best of success. And I imagine it will get made and people will really love it. So thank you very much for joining me on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thank you.
All right. My thanks to Lisa Fenn. I hope you enjoyed that. It's just a remarkable story. And Lisa Fenn is a pretty remarkable person, not just, all the Emmy Awards she won at ESPN, but just a champion as a human being. And we wish her and D'Artagnan and Leroy nothing but success. Thanks so much to my producer, Alan Kim, for working on this podcast. Bette Marston, the usual producer, worked hard as one of our Olympics editors. We got some cool podcasts coming up in the future, including Andy Roddick. Talk about his interesting sojourn into broadcasting after tennis. All right, for the group at Sports Illustrated, including Chris Stone, Ryan Hunt, John Worth, I'm Ben Eagle. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.